Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California and the Bay Gourmet Forum. My name is Naomi Starkman, and I will be the moderator for tonight's panel discussion on how the grocer and the consumer can take back food choices, with Sam McGannum of Buy Right Market, Rex Stewart of New Leaf Market, and Michael May of Harvest Hill Market. Also, thank you to the Bernard Osher Foundation for sponsoring this program, which is part of the club's Food Lit series. You can find out more about the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is in solidarity with Occupy San Francisco and Occupy Oakland. I'd like to think of tonight's program as being Occupy Your Grocery Store. So we have some experts here tonight who are leading the way to change and take back sort of what we know to be grocery or maybe what we don't know to be grocery with us. And we hope to have a very inspired and informed conversation. And I really do encourage you all to send your questions up here, and I want you to feel like you're part of the conversation as well. You know, this conversation was built about how consumers can take back their choice. These grocers really are doing the job, but it's our job as consumers every day and every single time we reach into our pocket to pay for food to ask questions as well. How is our food produced? Who's producing it? What are the conditions? So a little bit more about our panelists. With us tonight are Sam McGannum. Sam is the second-generation owner of Buy Right Market, San Francisco's premier neighborhood specialty food store. He is also the co-author of Buy Right Market's new book, Eat Good Food. If you haven't seen it, it's for sale, and it's a really helpful guide that walks you through the grocery store and also helps you identify questions you should be asking of your grocer in a way to sort of support a good food system. Next to Sam is... Rex Stewart. I put you guys in different order. I apologize. And Rex is the CEO of and founder and owner of New Leaf Market, which is in the South Bay region. And we were just talking a little bit before the panel. Rex was saying that his underlying mission is really to create community through food. And he does this in a number of ways, which we'll get into. New Leaf Community Markets has been around for the last 22 years, and he was previously the owner of Renovations, a consulting firm serving the natural food industry. New Leaf has 6 stores, and they're opening another store in San Jose, and they have about annual sales of about $60 million. They also contribute roughly 10% of their profits annually to local nonprofits. So thank you, Rex and Sam. And next to Rex is Michael May. And Michael was formerly the CEO of Empower Trainers and Consultants. There's a great Inc. Magazine profile of him, and it's a 1997 article that really is a great profile of him, though he was trying to downplay it previously. I really recommend you guys reading it. He had previous stints at Apple Computer, where he made his mark as one of the company's 5 top salespeople, hitting 225% of his $11 million annual quota. And before that, he served as an electrical engineer at Ross Perot's Electronic Data Systems. And now he owns Harvest Hills Market in Bernal Heights. So welcome, Michael. We have a lot to talk about tonight, and I hope you guys can share with us the wisdom of the grocers as well. So I want to just start and open the conversation with a kind of a very broad question, which is really one that we've all talked about, which is, you know, where you all see your role in feeding our society, what you see your personal role, your business's role, and sort of what you see the grocer's role currently is and how you'd like to see that changed. Maybe we can start with you, Sam.
Sure. Can you hear me? Sorry, get closer. Hi. Thanks for coming, everybody. My background is as a chef. You know, I grew up in the grocery business. It was the last thing that I wanted to do. And so when I graduated from high school, I went to hotel and restaurant management school and fell in love with cooking. And so I developed a relationship with food really early on. You know, when I was 18, I began to realize how valuable and how important the role of a feeder is to the people that are actually going to be consuming that food. You know, the creativity, the decision making in selecting the products can either make somebody feel good or make them sick. I mean, you know, we think about how many times, you know, food poisoning and happens from meals out or from, you know, industrial food system. It's awful. Nobody wants it. And I much prefer making people feel excited and getting them all fired up. And so I took that same philosophy, that same perspective as a chef, as a cook, and applied it to a grocery store. You know, whether I'm preparing a dish that's going to go into our deli case, selecting beef to sell in our butcher case, or a package of pasta to put on the shelf, I want to make sure that that product is going to taste good, that it's going to actually feed somebody more than just calories, that it's going to nurture them, that it's going to feed the community that's growing it, that's building it, that's providing it. And so we have a different perspective on how retail should work because of that. And it's something that I put a lot of energy and effort into my staff. You know, I'm constantly educating myself. I'm constantly educating my team. And in turn, we're trying to teach our guests, everybody who walks in the door, in order for them to be able to feel like they're making positive decisions in supporting and nurturing our community.
Rex, what about for you and your vision, sort of what the grocer's role is in feeding our society?
Well, like Sam, well, I was a product of the 60s, so everything was alternative back then to whatever was happening. We were always looking for an alternate style of life. And food being an everyday part of my life, I gravitated towards focusing on that as an alternate. And I was really involved with the co-op movement in the 70s up in Humboldt County, also managed the co-op on the island of Kauai for a while. But back then, you know, natural foods were in the organic food industry. I don't think really there was organic at that point in time, at least closely defined, was really all about people bringing food to the back door of your store and delivering it. A bag of grain, some kiwis that they just picked, some turnips or whatever. And it really wasn't an industry at that point in time. So I feel like our company and myself, our overreaching goal has always been to eliminate the steps between the consumer and the food that they're purchasing at our store. So we become a vehicle for farmers and for small food artisans, for that cheesemaker, for that raw milk producer, a place that they can bring their product to the marketplace. And we, in turn, can represent that through education, educate the consumer of what they're actually getting and where it's coming from, and basically eliminate as many steps as we can. So when you sit down at your table at home, you can say, oh, this milk is from this dairy here, and I met that person at New Leaf last week, or I know where this cheese actually came from, or this beef was grass-fed in Humboldt County. It was put on a truck and driven directly to New Leaf. So there was like two steps involved with that. And I met the farmer last December because he came down and did the demo. So that, you know, that's basically, basically, we try to keep to our creed of making, delivering that on a daily basis and not get distracted with too many other things and make that our basic tenet.
What about you?
Well, I'm a software guy that came to California, and unfortunately I fell in love with a woman that had just picked up a market, and the market was in Bernal Heights. And her goal was to bring healthy food to the neighborhood. The reason that she had that goal was she had married she traveled the world, and she had married a San Franciscan, and 2 months after she married him, he died of leukemia. And so that was a very painful process for her. And so she set out over a 2 or 3 year period to go research the other organic markets in town and buy in an organic market with the money that she had saved and with her brother's help. And so we took over the market and have worked very hard to learn where the different produce comes from, the different suppliers. We buy primarily through the distributors and not the farmers today, although we're starting to talk to the farmers and learn so that over the next 2 years we can do that. Our store is much smaller. We took it over only a year and a half ago, probably 10 people, but we've been growing at 10 to 15% a month. And the neighborhood has has accepted the market and is appreciated. Our goal is to open 2 stores a year. 2,000 to 4,000 square feet. Our typical customer is a person that goes to Whole Foods. Many of them have come to us now and said, if you'll get these five items, I will surrender, and I won't have to drive an extra 20 minutes each night. And that's part of our goal, is to build the community and say, hey, you can take back that 15 minutes that you would have had to drive across town and come back. You can just come down to the neighborhood. We're trying to add a butcher side to our business, similar to what Sam has, and some other prepared foods, so it is easy for them to get all the things that they need right on their corner.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about what was in your store space before you guys took over?
Yeah, the store was open since 1918. It was owned by the Kinsella family, who had it as a full grocer and then sold it, I think, in the late 60s. It went through three different owners. The prior owner to us didn't show up, hired some teenagers. If you look at the Yelp reviews, it's like if you want someone to flip cigarettes at you and come to this store. You know, so there was maybe $10,000 worth of inventory when we took over the store. It looked extremely empty. It now has over $500,000 worth of inventory. Probably $300,000 of that is wine. So we have a very large wine selection. Hope for no earthquakes anytime soon. But the store today has, we do maybe $50,000 a month in produce, whereas when we took it over, there was no produce in the store. And so we're probably a mix of 70% organic and 30% conventional.
So a lot of you from the audience have been sending up questions, and you asked a really good question, which I was about to get to, which is, where's Walmart? And this event tonight was billed as having a Walmart representative, and we are really disappointed that Walmart chose to decline to participate. And I don't know why. I can just tell you that what we have here tonight are examples of grocers who are building a different kind of system. One of the questions that came up was, with Walmart not here, can you give us your candid opinion on the role that Walmart or Costco can play in changing our current food system, or will they? Sam, you want to take a crack at that?
I would have been candid whether they were here or not.
The question is,
should they or will they be able to?
And for those of you who don't know, Walmart announced last year around this time a major initiative to roll out a sustainable agricultural program, where they have said that they would source food more locally and also invest in training farmers.
How do I answer that? I think the answer is with all of you. It's going to really take a public that changes its desires and changes what it demands from a grocer and how a grocer delivers before Walmart, Target, Costco, and the rest will change. It's interesting. The way I view Walmart as a food seller, they could sell shoes or tomatoes. It doesn't matter. They're just looking at it as a product that they buy at a certain price. They can squeeze the hell out of their supplier until they get the price that they feel that they can actually mark up just enough so they can make their margin and move quickly. It's all about moving pallets and pallets and truckload after truckload, warehouse after warehouse, full of product. And so they'll move whatever the consumers want. They'll also move whatever Madison Avenue wants them to move. The advertisers spend millions upon millions of dollars annually on advertising products that are made from cheap ingredients, and they need partners in order to sell that product. It's not like Kellogg's is on the street actually hawking the product. They need people like Walmart and Safeway in order to sell cornflakes, millions and millions of boxes of cornflakes. And so until that pressure gets exerted on these multinational corporations that are benefiting from the subsidies that we're all paying for, that supply won't change. And so we need everybody to change what they view as good food, what they want as good food, what they buy on a daily basis, if we're going to be able to influence them. I don't think it's going to come from any sort of desire internally on their part.
You guys have any thoughts on Walmart? I mean, more than half of their annual sales are made in the grocery department, mm-hmm. So it's a substantial,
70%, you know. 70%, I think.
I think it's almost 70%.
I mean, Walmart, practically invented the Industrial Food Society in a way. and the way that food is moved thousands of miles at very cheap prices. I mean, that is their model. And I believe that they, you know, they throw herrings every once in a while to sustainability because I think it's a popular thing to do for them. But their model is not based on sustainability. It's based on, like you said, Sam said, is cheap food at cheap prices. And it doesn't matter if it comes from China or Uruguay or Arkansas or Texas. That's what they want to do. And until, like you say, the consumer changes that model for them, they're going to continue to tout that model, be it Costco, Safeway, or yeah, it's all about it. It's an industrial farming model, so it'll continue.
Yeah, I think that I went to a school in southern Missouri, an engineering school, and Walmart recruited heavily because their headquarters was probably less than 500 miles away. So they have some extremely intelligent people in that organization, and you see the way that they do business, and they will absolutely affect how the grocery work is done. I haven't been to their stores down here, but Dixon and up in that area, I've watched what they brought in, how they do it, what they're selling the prices at. The interesting piece for us is because we buy very aggressively produce, and we beat Safeway and Whole Foods and Walmart's pricing. And people ask, how can you do that? And the answer is, well, it's not necessarily good at certain times to be that big because JMB was probably the main person that brings in a lot of the asparagus out here. And JMB says, well, these guys have to buy a large block and they have to commit early. Whereas you come in and you know that it rained on Thursday, so you can buy on Wednesday because the farmer had to bring all those crops in early because he knew it was going to rain. And so we can actually make split-second decisions or split-day decisions to buy and save over what they bought at because they committed to that 3 to 5 weeks earlier. And so we do that. We walk into the coolers in the morning and we look and say, well, there's 12 pallets of strawberries today. There should be one pallet of strawberries here. And the reason was that the weather was going to get cold in Santa Monica or down south, and they had to bring all those in. Well, that means the price changes. So we get to bring that price down. We bring it to our neighborhood. They eat a lot more strawberries than candy bars. That's a good thing for our neighborhood. So Walmart, has its own challenges in the produce business. The prepared foods and canned things, they're going to do just like they did everywhere else. They're going to bring that in a low margin. They're going to squeeze their suppliers. They have that methodology down well. So they'll do very well on certain parts of the food business. Other parts of the business, I think they'll have a challenge associated with it.
I just want to take a minute and read from this article that was in the New York Times. The Bay Citizen, which is a local outfit that reprints the New York Times, had an article back in September, and the title was "Local Grocery Stores Try to Find Traction in Rough Times." Just to kind of give us a step back and look at the landscape of grocery stores, many of us might know about Fresh and Easy, which is a new entry into the market. It's a British-based grocery store that's opened a new headquarters in Bayview, Hunters Point. It's the first grocery store in that area in decades. And I'm just quoting from the article here. Squeezed by expensive purveyors of organic, local, and artisanal products on the high end and discounters like Costco and Walmart on the low end, as well as a slow economy, traditional supermarket chains are reeling, with store closings and bankruptcies sweeping the sector. The venerable Bay Area chain Andronico's, a family-owned company with 7 stores in the region, filed for bankruptcy protection 2 weeks ago and just announced it will sell itself to a private equity firm through its Chapter 11 filings. Its troubles follow those of Delano's IGA, which closed last fall after a failed expansion effort that included taking over troubled Cala Bell Foods. In 2006, the supermarket giant Albertsons began closing all of its San Francisco stores, and the last traditional supermarket chain to open a branch in the city was Safeway in the South of Market District in 2004. So one of the questions that came up from the audience was, given that landscape and seeing sort of a shrinking traditional market and seeing an opening and sort of a proliferation of small local markets, how big is too big? So the question here is, what's the optimal number of stores for each of you? Do you want to grow to the size of Whole Foods? If not, why not? How will you be any different?
Well, I could start there. I mean, it's hard to say how big is too big or how big is real big. It's really about keeping your credentials and your integrity together. We're going to open our 7th store in San Jose, and we feel, like I said before, our basic tenets are in place. And every community that we go into, we look for a community that needs to have a place, a food store, but something that creates actually identity for their community. We have a store in Half Moon Bay, and before that, all they had was a Safeway. We became part of that community. We are now known kind of as, like I had, I was telling the story earlier, we've had, a person to come up to me a couple of weeks ago and said, you are part of the fabric of this community because you're part of the conversation every day. Like, I saw my friend there, the New Leaf gave money to this or that. So that was, I said, that's the highest compliment that I could ever get, is that we're part of the fabric of the community. So we look for opportunities like that. And I think we can continue to grow as long as we stay close to the wanting to continue to have that relationship with the communities that we're in. We're not interested in being as large as Whole Foods. We're not interested in being a publicly traded company, which I think when you go that route, you then are beholden to a whole different group of people. but we are interested in being large enough to pay a living wage to our employees, to be able to continue to hire people that are interested in working in this industry and being able to contribute to all the communities that we become involved with.
I want to hear from Sam. In doing our research, we continue to go into BuyRight over and over and over again. And I, as a pure entrepreneur, I was scratching my head saying, why doesn't this guy have 10 locations right now? I mean, it's fantastic. All this stuff is tremendous. And so I'm interested, Sam, to hear.
I have no desire to be at the scale of Whole Foods whatsoever. You know, we're opening a second store next spring, and this was like one of the biggest decisions of my life. You know, I mean, it's 14 years we've been running the market on 18th Street, and it's incredible. You know how that community's evolved. You know, I was recounting to Naomi earlier today, you know, when we took over the market in 97, you know, the same block between Guerrero and Dolores, the same number of commercial storefronts as there are today, there were about 35 jobs on that block. 14 years later, there's well over 400. By the first quarter of next year, two new restaurants will have opened and will probably be close to 500 people working on one block. And to me, this is an example of how important a grocer is in a community. It becomes an anchor. It becomes a center for community life. It inspires and attracts other businesses to want to be near there, to be near that foot traffic, to actually synergize and to grow together. And I take that responsibility so seriously. I take the responsibility of feeding and taking care of my community so seriously that, I mean, the thought right now of trying to do it in a second store is freaking me out, you know. It is. I'm serious, you know. And if it wasn't for, you know, the amazing team that I have and a few key people that I know I can trust to do it and to realize the same vision and who are also feeders and who are also teachers, I feel confident that we can do it. I'm scared, but I feel really excited about the impact that we're going to have on a new community and the ability, the power of seeing, you know, another block blossom into a hub for life.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with Sam McGannum of BuyRight Market, Rex Stewart of New Leaf Market, and Michael May of Harvest Mill Market about how the grocer and consumer can take back food choice. So some of the questions that came up here, and I would say there's a good dozen, all ask the same question. And this is obviously on everyone's mind, and I don't think this will surprise any of you in the slightest. And the question essentially is, how do we make good food affordable and accessible to all?
Good question. To all. That's the part that's really hard because, defining good food, I guess we're defining it as natural, organic, local, accessible to the consumer. So I think there's a number of ways that we can make it affordable. We have direct relationships with a number of farmers and other food purveyors that allow us to cut out certain price tiers, be it wholesale, marketing money, all that kind of money that actually goes into driving food prices up. So we're actually buying the food from the people that are making it without them having to advertise it or sell it to somebody else first. So that's the one way. I think another way that we're able to keep our prices as affordable as we can is to basically form partnerships with suppliers and people that then respect us, respect the partnership, that we're moving forward, so we're working in the best interest of both the supplier and our company to keep prices down and to run a program on an annual basis. And then just to be able to try to to be able to spot buy, because we are much more nimble than the larger Safeway stores and that type of store, that we can buy on the market when there is like a rain and the asparagus needs to be bought. We can jump in and get that, and the strawberries and so on and so forth. So I think in our perimeter in our stores, which I consider to be the food service, produce, dairy, deli area, you know, our prices are right there with the conventional grocer, but we have an organic offering. And, we just try to keep our prices as low as we can. And, of course, we have to also address that we have a cost structure that we have to be able to flourish and be able to be profitable so we can also feed our employees. So, but it's tough in this particular market in the United States right now because of the subsidies U.S. government subsidies that go towards the industrial food manufacturing. And I was just out in Iowa for the organic pork producers dinner, which was just great. All the farmers kind of slicked their hair back, and got dressed up, and came to town. And it was up Nyman Ranch put it on. But while we were out touring the farms, we went to the organic farm. And for every organic farm, there was 75 hog sheds where the hogs were indoors, never saw the light of day. And that's what 96% of the country is getting for pork. And thank God I was involved with the 4% group. But but the truth of the matter is we have a long ways to go to make good food affordable when the bad food is so affordable due to a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to go, Michael?
Yeah, go. I'm still looking for the solution. I'll find it.
We might have to elect you to president if you do.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's thousands of people working on this issue. Naomi, I feel so many of the groups that you advise and work with, are trying to tackle this question. There's no simple answer, and there's no answer that we're not going to come to resolution up here at this panel. To me, when you ask how it's to make it more accessible to all, I think we need to change our definition as the current food system is of what good food is. My preference would be to have this natural and organic food be what is the norm as opposed to the exception, which it currently is. But if we are going to feed everybody, I'd rather see us feed them fresh food. And whether it's conventionally grown or organically grown, I'd rather see people go to the market and buy fresh food and cook more. Frankly, there's too much money being spent on this overly processed crap, and it's not feeding us. It's poisoning us. And when you think about the health epidemics that we're facing, two-thirds of adults in this country are obese. Half of the children in this country are overweight or obese. We spend $125 billion a year on dealing with health issues around obesity. About 80 million of those dollars are preventable through better diet and through exercise. We need to put our emphasis on that, on just getting people to buy a chicken and some broccoli and some rice and go home and cook and share a meal with their family to slow down, as opposed to going to the drive-thru and picking up McDonald's or a TV dinner or whatever other crap that there is out there. And so it is a long-term project, like you said. I mean, and it's something that we're all trying to fight. I mean, I do think that so much of the answer is in the consumer and changing the consumer perception, but so much is out of their control. Minimum wage has been kept artificially low. I think the national minimum wage is $6.75. It hasn't been adjusted to inflation. People just can't afford it, and frankly, it pisses me off. And I wish it was different. But one step at a time. If we can get people to have one meal a week at home, that's one meal that's better, right? It's one step closer.
Yeah, I agree with Sam on that side. We've seen as the economy has slowed down, people not eating out as much and eating in. So, you know, in talking to customers every night, we're seeing a number of people that are coming in and making their own dinners and learning that, you know, cooking together is a great thing. The other side of the question, the bigger question for me, was, you know, how do you make it more accessible? The reality is that these big corporations, Tyson and everybody else, are well run. I mean, they have very good business plans, well thought out. In dealing with a lot of entrepreneurs, I won the Entrepreneur Year Award, and I consult with a lot of entrepreneurs around the country. And so when I look at businesses, I look at what they do and don't do right. And so the majority, I would say, I would bet that the majority of the smaller farmers that we have out there and the medium-sized groups that are producing the products that you would like to have and I'd like to have are probably not running off of a business plan, are not getting the advice that they need on how to run efficiently and how to bring their costs down and how to get the best price for their product. Many of those places do sell to Earls and other places that are intermediaries where they could feasibly go direct and get a better profit like that you said you were helping out. So I would say in a bigger picture, some way of reaching out to those farms and farmers to help them run more efficiently would help bring the cost down a little bit. And maybe coming direct to different markets would also bring the price down to us, which we could pass on to the customer.
Just to tie back to our earlier note or nod to occupy your grocery store, I want to just point out that 80% of the food system, at least the meat system in this country, is owned by four companies. So what we're talking about is consolidation on a really unbelievable level that, you know, is a barrier to entry for many small producers that don't have access to distribution, transportation, and aggregation that the large companies certainly do. So part of the affordability is about scaling up. And so one of the questions, some of the questions that came up was a lot of the questions had to do with how do you scale up the good food movement and how do people get access to it. And I want to kind of drill in here a little bit and ask you more specifically, how does food get from the producer, the grower, to your consumer? Just walk us through the nitty-gritty so that the average consumer really gets a sense of what it takes to get food from your store onto their table.
Yeah, I think that everybody has access to this. And there was a filmmaker that came to us and wanted to do a story on our store. And I said, no, don't waste your time. Go down to the terminal at 2 in the morning and watch. It's like a hive of bees.
The produce terminal?
The produce terminals. And it's the scariest place and one of the most interesting things you'll ever see. Basically, the farmers will pull the product off the field all day long, and then it will come into three main terminals, one in Oakland, one in off of Bayshore, and then one down by the airport. And so they'll offload these massive trucks. And at the same time, the buyers are coming in and buying that product from 1 till 3 a.m. for the bigger stores. The smaller stores like us may show up at 4, 5, 6 a.m. because we want to sleep. But it's a massive transition of food. So the bulk of the produce is picked fresh, shipped up there. They'll throw it into their coolers, and you're welcome to walk down there. Oakland is very easy to get into. It's right on the streets. They unload right on the street. They put it back in at 10 o'clock. It's open from midnight till 10 a.m. And the one at the one off of Gerald is a great location. And so that's the way the bulk of that produce comes. More advanced retailers like a Berkeley Bowl, they'll bring in all that product or the bulk of that product themselves. When they can't, then they'll show up all of a sudden and wipe out, you know, 20 pallets of strawberries right before we got there because they needed them, couldn't get them from their main supplier. So as far as the produce, that's the way I understand the bulk of it that goes through. The rest of it, the canned goods and things, there are big distributors like UNFI, Life's Best, Tony's. You'll see their trucks around town. They bring in a lot of the products for the stores. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, with our model, you know, we're fortunate to be, our headquarters are in Santa Cruz, so we're fortunate to be kind of in an organic breadbasket of sorts. And so a lot of the growers and a lot of the produce you might see up here in the city or further north or whatever starts in Santa Cruz. And we have a lot of growers that come basically delivered to our back door before they go and sell to the wholesale. So we're getting a fresher product, and we're also delivering a better price to them, and they're delivering a better price to us, so we can in turn deliver a better price to the consumer. And I think that – so that's a big advantage I think we have. That increases accessibility. Secondly, you know, our business model is willing to accept you coming to the door and saying, I'm raising this product, or I've got this this grass-fed beef, or I have a program that I'm working on. How could I? And then you can actually will foster that program and help people work towards reaching their goals as a food producer, and carry the product in our store and nurture that along. You know, you will not get that in the big conventional supermarkets. There's no way you could knock on a Safeway's door and say, and they'll say, well, you know, we'll have to have 50 meetings. It'll have to become approved. Blah 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 blah. And so we are accessible to the food suppliers, so that they could have a place to sell those products. And then we, in turn, try to give them a fair price for their products, because their survival is as important as getting the price to the consumer at a fair price too. And so it can all kind of work in that way. So I think our accessibility to the provider and the accessibility then we can provide to the consumer is an advantage that we have.
I think, you know, we're more nimble because we're smaller, you know. And you know, one thing that Michael you were talking to me about earlier, and I know this is also true for you, Rex, but we also buy for taste. You know, we're not just like buying off of some list, calling up some broker and saying I need, you know, half a truckload of this and half a truckload of that. I need it tomorrow. You know, and that's basically the Walmart way, right? It doesn't matter where the peaches are coming from. It doesn't matter how good the peaches taste. They need 10 pallets, and they need them to come to this distribution center so they can get them out to the various number of stores so that they have a product to sell. Whereas for us, it's about a relationship. We want to know where our food's coming from. We want to know that it tastes good. We want to know how it's grown, who grew it, and then we want to share that with the people that we're actually going to sell it to. It's an important part of our business model. But we represent a very small percentage businesses like ours represent a very small percentage of how business is done. Most businesses is done literally through brokers. And you know, the food will typically go from the fields to a processing center where it'll be sorted, graded, packaged. And then from that processing center, it'll go to another handling facility from which it then goes out to distribution centers. And then from the distribution centers, it might go to another distribution specific center that's for the market, or it might go directly to the stores. And so by the time it gets to the actual consumer, four or five hands will have touched it. Whereas in the case like BuyRite and New Leaf, you know, most of our products, I mean, you know, I think we counted it out. It was almost 60% in the case of our store comes actually direct from the grower, the rancher, the cheesemaker, or the producer of the food. And so much of our food is actually coming. It's a one-to-one relationship, and that's the way we prefer it. That's the way we want it, because we know that money is actually going to the person that is putting that effort and time into it.
So one of the questions I had planned on asking you all, but also was sort of echoed in the questions from the audience tonight, is a little bit about consumer participation in the process. And I had wanted to ask you all, really, what are the top three questions consumers should be asking their grocer? And some of the audience members had great questions along those lines around how consumers can exert their own influence on the marketplace. What actions can they take? What behaviors beyond cooking? And if there are good examples of places where people can learn to cook that are doing a good job and sort of educating in that regard, but what are the other steps that you all are hoping that consumers will ask of you?
Can I take that one first? Mm-hmm. I love this question. Who asked it?
Raise your hand.
No, I do. It's an awesome question, and I'm going to just share an example of how consumers shaped BuyRite. 14 years ago when we started the store, it was very different from what it is today. We had a mix of commodity, conventional products and crops, and organic. Taste was the defining factor, much more so than sustainability was. I wanted, you know, as a cook, as a chef, I wanted products that were ingredient-driven, that were recipe-driven, that... okay. I thought you were itching to say something. It was through our guests. It was through people who shopped at the store who made us aware of the issues around farmed salmon, who made us aware of, you know, how highly sprayed conventional corn is, who brought the Dirty Dozen list to us, or whatever it may be, you know, and it's like, that's the power of community. It's the power of individuals going in and exercising their ability to tell their grocer, to feel confident in sharing, something that is valuable to them and telling them, hey, I'm not going to buy salmon from you any longer unless you stock wild salmon. And, you know, by the time two or three people say that to a fishmonger, that fishmonger is going to say, I got to bring wild salmon and I'm going to stop selling farm because I'm going to lose money. I'm not going to be able to conduct business. And so that influence is tremendous. Saying no is one of the, I think, one of the most powerful things that consumers can do when they're in the retail space. You know, especially retailers like, you know, the big retailers, the supermarkets, you know, for them, like I was saying earlier, it's all about moving product and moving it quick. If their customer base starts migrating to alternative avenues for getting food, they're going to adapt. I mean, Walmart, you know, started bringing in dairy that was hormone free, and that was because they saw, you know, a market share loss, and they wanted to maintain a viable business. So you have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the customers shape our product line all the time. I mean, they either buy it or they don't. You know, so, I mean, we breathe things in, and I'm always saying, you know, our food service director will say, should we put that on the shelf? I said, well, let's put it out there, and then the customers will decide if it's a good product or not, as long as it fits into the criteria of product that we carry and it meets our specifications. And so it's really not up to us to decide what's good for them, for you. It's up to you to decide what's good for you. And so we have lots of failures, and we have lots of successes in that regard. You know, we run a sustainable fish program that we were the pioneers with the sustainable fish with Fishwise. We actually worked that program out. Safeway just adopted that program. We were the first store to have it. But it's a consumer-based choice program where the consumer chooses to buy either, you know, the fish are labeled red, yellow, and green, green being the most sustainable. So we labeled our fish case like that. The consumers decided not to buy the red anymore in our stores. So within a year, we had no more red. We only had yellow and green, and now we have very few yellow. And that was a consumer-driven program. So you vote with your dollars. I mean, I think the biggest issue that we're kind of facing right now is the whole GMO issue, genetically modified organisms, and that's going to have to be a huge consumer upswell to kind of change the tide in regards to that. I mean, once again, on this trip I just took to Iowa, and 96% of the corn raised in Iowa now is GMO, Roundup Ready, Monsanto corn. Only 4% is organic, and 40% of that corn is used for biofuel, which takes, you know, more energy to produce a gallon of biofuel. And you know, it goes back to government subsidy again. So it's, you know, it's consumer voice, consumer involvement that, you know, shapes what we carry in the store, but also can shape policy and the way that this country will start treating food and food issues.
Yeah, and our store is a startup. I mean, we relied on our customers to tell us what they wanted. We put out little cards that said, you know, tell us the products that we don't have today that you want. And oftentimes those were the best products to carry because they tasted good, they were well manufactured, they came in at a decent price. And so that worked out well for us to grow, is to ask our customers, and they showed us what we needed. As it relates to the produce, again, that's where I spend the most of my mornings, down tasting all the produce. I'm down there with the founder of Berkeley Bowl and other people tasting each thing. And it's funny to see what they show you, and then you have to refuse it 3 to 4 times, and then they go, okay, well, back here in the very back is the good stuff we were going to ship to Japan today. And so then you pull that out, and that's the good product that you were really looking for. And so it's a fight sometimes to get the best produce, and you have to get down there and scrap with the other people and look for it. And sometimes that can be a fun process.
And just like that, consumers should do the same. It sounds like you're all advocating just fight for good food on your grocery store shelves. So I want to ask sort of a two-part question from the audience. One was a really kind of a great take on this, and I just want to read it right out. It took a British company to open a store in Bayview. Why are there no, quote-unquote, local community-oriented organic stores like all of yours there? That's the first part of the question. And then also sort of stepping outside of that view, what will it take to have local grocers be successful outside of the Bay Area foodie bubble?
Well, the second part of the question, not being a San Francisco-based company, I can say that the Bayview issue is really not an issue for us because I'm not even familiar with the neighborhood, really. But I'm assuming that it's an impoverished kind of neighborhood. It hasn't had a grocery store for a long time or food desert. So there's always opportunity to open stores, of course, in a food desert. But second part of the question was?
What will it take to have local grocers be successful out of the Bay Area foodie bubble?
Okay. I think it takes to be the best grocery store. Is that simple? Be the best operator when you come in, and don't just assume that because you sell organic or natural or sustainable food that you're going to be successful, that you need to be a part of the fabric, like I said earlier, the community, get really involved with the community, and then be the most friendly, cleanest, well-merchandised grocery store in the area. So you become the best choice for the consumer. And you're not just resting on the laurel of selling organic, natural food, but you are the best store for them to shop at.
I think for us, I mean, I'm not afraid to open 10 stores tomorrow. I'm used to running a firm that big. And as we try to get that done, the roadblocks for us in the San Francisco area are unique. For me, I came from the Midwest. We opened locations all around the country for our software business. And here, it took 17 months to transition the ownership of the store that we currently have. And that was a combination of issues, but primarily related to the city and the state. And along that way, you know, you can count that the price of milk is probably 50 cents higher because of all the steps that we had to go through to get it done. And I watch it. There's a new cafe opening at the end of our street, Presida Park Cafe. It's the Dolores Park Cafe chain. And she got 6 months free rent, and she's into her 10th month of non-free rent, and she still hasn't opened. And so as we look at our second, third, and fourth locations, we're factoring that in to our startup, that it will take us between 12 to 18 months to get that location open. So if I was to say, you know, how do I get there quicker? You know, somebody in government say, okay, well, we think you're a good guy. We think organic produce is a great thing. Let's mow these roadblocks down for you, if possible, and help you get it done quicker. I mean, I can find the money to do it. I can hire the people. I can train the people. And we can do a great job of bringing product to market, but it is very difficult to sustain the startup costs of a 14 to 18-month process while you get through all the permitting and everything else. We're building a parklet outside of our store right now. The city came to us and asked us to do it. That process is probably 6 months along right now, and we're still trying to get the exact right drawing, you know, done so that they're happy with a parklet, and it's, you know, two car lengths long. So it's very interesting dealing with that. I'm not used to that, but there are benefits to that too, you know, safety and all things. But at the same time, I would like some help mowing down those obstacles and getting through it quicker.
Yeah, in regards to the Bayview question, you know, I consider what Michael did opening his market up and what we did, you know, 14 years ago to be similar examples. You know, both of those neighborhoods were deserts of sorts. You know, Michael's store is a block and a half away from the projects. I mean, how far is it?
Two
blocks away from the projects. And for years, there were no good grocers in that neighborhood. I mean, all the grocers there sold, you know, liquor, cigarettes, Doritos, and Hostess cupcakes. And Byright was the same. You know, the Dolores Park was the center of drug trade in San Francisco. If you wanted heroin, that's where you would go. And when we took over in 97 and took the bars down off our windows, the same kind of bars that you'd see in markets in the Bayview, people thought I was crazy. And they were like, dude, your windows are going to be broken every day. And I was like, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to deal with it. Because the last thing I want to do is work in a prison. And we took the bars down and we held firm and together with our community built a community market, and it takes. I mean, what we do is not easy. It's a ton of work, and it's a serious commitment, and it has to be a lifelong passion in order to do it. You know, I continually hope, and one of the reasons why, you know, I wrote Eat Good Food was I hope to inspire a new generation of people to realize that being a grocer is
is a great profession. You know, and we've gotten to the place where restaurateurs and chefs have been idolized and glamorized, and yet so much of us get our food from grocery stores way more than we get them from restaurants. They're an important part of our daily thread and can be so integral to our community life. And I don't know if you guys don't mind, I brought this book that was written in 1934 in the middle of the Depression, and it's called Jimmy the Grocery Man. And no, it's awesome. I've got this crazy thing for collecting old books. And especially books about grocery stores, and this was a book that was written as part of the Community Life series. Imagine there being books that were talking about community life, and it was written for second and third graders. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the editor's foreword. Jimmy the Grocery Man is the first book in a new series designed to give children in primary grade simple but accurate information concerning various important aspects of community life. I mean, imagine that, you know, this is not that long ago that we valued professions like grocery store owners, you know, that we felt that it was important to teach our elementary school kids about them. The books have a twofold function, that of supplying interesting reading material with a carefully checked vocabulary to meet the requirements of reading programs, and authentic social studies information to meet the requirements of activity or integrated unit of work programs. Teachers using this book should take advantage of the many opportunities it presents for helping children to understand community relationships. I mean, to me, that's like one of the most powerful lines in this whole thing. I mean, it is. It's about a relationship. We've gotten so distant from understanding where our food comes from, down to the anonymity that we feel inside a supercenter or most grocery stores. I mean, I love that you talk about these relationships that you're building, that people recognize how valuable you are to them. I mean, you're going to flip Bernal. No, really, Bernal's going to be like one of the hottest neighborhoods. It is, but it's going to tenfold what it is, and that to me is like how valuable the work that we do. Anyway, I mean, you get the picture. There's a lot more of really cool things that are stated in this book, but we need to just change that perception and take that back and you know, it's so much of why we put this whole panel together was to just to empower you to be out there and to be spread that word and to really be conscious of those decisions that you make every day and how they do impact the community that you live in. And they can have this super positive impact, or they can have a negative impact. And you know, it's just like feeding somebody, right? It's the same deal. Ideally, and I believe that it's inherent in every human that we want to do right by others, you know, and we want to be part of bringing a positive, being a positive impact on the people that we interact with and have relationships with.
I wanted to add a quick story about flipping Bernal. We have a school that's run by the church, and they're attention deficit disorder kids and kids that have problems. Early on, we noticed that these people kept coming down with these kids, and they give them $2. And it was, if they were really good in class, they would get $2. And, of course, what were they buying? They were buying a soda and a candy bar. And now those kids come down, and all of our people have slowly worked with these kids and the teachers. And now the kids come down and go, look, for $2, I can actually get 3 things of strawberries. I can have one for myself and then give the rest to the class. And we just thought, yeah, that's so neat. And that, you know, because one thing that you think that they don't need is an attention deficit disorder is a Coke and a candy bar. And so less sugar, or probably better sugar, from the strawberries and other things. Yeah.
Did you want to add something, Rex?
Well, you know, I mean, food is what we all have in common. And if you want to rebuild community, food is the best way to do so. We all want to gather it in some way. And if we can go someplace and gather it where it actually has meaning, and we can see our friends and see our acquaintances and see the people maybe that produce the food and take that home and then treasure that and understand where it comes from, I mean, that's the greatest gift that I think that we can give as grocers. And, you know, we're trying to hearken back to a way that things were not too long ago. I mean, the Industrial Food Revolution is really only 50 years old. And I think we owe it to ourselves as human beings to get as close to the food as we can. And we're trying to be community centers for that. That's our goal.
It's one of the most humble acts we can engage in.
So one of the last questions I want to ask you is really about sort of where you guys see yourself surviving in the big box business society. So as the Walmarts and the Costcos and now Walgreens is entering into the food market, where do you sort of see the future of food for yourselves? And then I guess, you know, in the inverse, can the big box society survive you guys?
Yeah, they have a little bigger bank accounts than we do, I'm sure. I think that from our standpoint, we've looked at it as what can we do that Safeway can't do? So we can introduce people to blood oranges that have never tried a blood orange before, dragon fruit or different things, and show them the value of that and show them how much fun food can be. You're just not going to get that in a Safeway checkout. I don't know if Walgreens can do that, but there's certain rules and regulations that those big companies have that make it very hard for them to operate that way. We don't have those issues because we're small and nimble. So I think that, San Francisco is unique in that the problems I talked about earlier also stop us from getting a Walmart down the street in 10 minutes or a Safeway duking it out with a Target and a Nugget, which would then really put the strain on our business. And so there is some extra benefit to being in San Francisco because of that. But I think that the big companies will continue to make inroads, but I think all of us are seeing the switch to the natural products and the relationship with the customers, and I think a lot of people actually want that, especially in San Francisco, want to talk to their grocer. And they come down every night and talk to us, and we're happy to see them every night in the morning. It's a fairly fun process. I don't know that it's that fun at a Walmart or a Walgreens or a Safeway at 10 o'clock at night.
And I want to just add into that question the equation of Trader Joe's. I mean, it's one of the brands that hasn't been spoken about tonight, or one of the retailers, and, you know, sort of how they play in the mix in this question.
Yeah, they scare me a little more. I mean, they're fun and they have good pricing and everything else. So of all the stores that I've watched, I mean, Trader Joe's is one that's like, that's it. And the pricing is phenomenal. So, I mean, you guys probably have a better opinion. You compete with them more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I mean, I think Trader Joe's and Whole Foods have differentiated themselves from the conventional grocer. I think Times are going to get really ugly for the conventional grocer. They're all really competing for the same competing with the same product. If you go into a Safeway or an Albertsons or a Kroger, I mean, there's really very very little difference other than, you know, the way the stores are laid out or the lighting or the uniforms. But it's basically all the same commodity crops and canned foods and everything else. I feel businesses like ours are continually going to thrive and grow as more and more people are wanting to find careers in food and become farmers or become ranchers or become food artisans. There's so many new picklers and jam makers and salumi makers sprouting up all around the country. I mean, there's this huge movement there where people are realizing that, you know, they can do something that they are passionate about, and there's nothing more powerful than doing something that you love, and then finding an audience to buy it, right, to share it with, and so we're nimble enough to constantly be able to bring those people in quickly. We nurture them, we see them grow. Sometimes they end up then taking that next step and starting to sell to a Whole Foods. You know, at that point we make a strategic decision as to whether to continue to support them or not. If they start giving Whole Foods a better price, then we do stop supporting them because we feel that they haven't been respectful of the partnership that we've had. But that excitement that's in this food space right now is I think gonna drive more people into getting into retail, drive more people to doing the work that we do. Brooklyn's a perfect example. I was just there a week ago, and every neighborhood now in Brooklyn has like a little community market of some sort or another that's trying to, you know, sell the food of these artisans that are in that space. It's pretty cool.
I mean, to the Trader Joe's question, we have, you know, two Trader Joe's, one across the street from our store downtown Santa Cruz, and I mean it's a different offering. It's a commodity-driven offering, similar to the more based on the model of the Walmart or Safeway, I mean, they're buying commodity and they're selling it, and they tell a great marketing story. But a lot of the product is very similar to what you'll find at other stores. But they're very popular. But we coexist very nicely because our story is a different story. You know, we can tell the story of the produce guy or the meat guy, and it's real and it's original. So they do their business and we do our business, and I think we complement each other very nicely in the marketplace. So I don't think, in my mind, none of the other businesses for me are anything to be really afraid of. We have two Whole Foods that operate in our marketplace also. We have, you know, giant lifestyle Safeways. We just try to focus on doing what we do and do it well because we believe in what we do is the best thing to do. So if we just do that well, we really don't have to worry about anybody else. So.
One question I thought was a really good one was whether there's any existing or planned cooperation between smaller markets. And the audience member asked or noted that the Bay Area food co-ops used to collective bargain with suppliers to get lower prices, whether you all have information about that in terms of cooperation.
Well, we're members of INFRA, which is Independent Natural Food Retailers Association, as Sam is too. I don't know if you are or not. And then one of the things that we've been doing is trying to pool our resources to bring prices down, especially on commodity goods, on cans and bottles, as I like to call them, you know, and finding a way to be able to compete more on that level. And that's a national organization at this point in time. So that's been a good going concern now for a few years.
Yeah. And one of the greatest challenges for our markets is that the big stores work on a cost plus model. So, you know, whatever the cost may be from the distributor or the supplier, they'll add like 7.5% margin to it. And so they're getting their you know, these I guess the I hate to call them commodity products, but what would you call them? I guess the shelf stable products,
candy
the grocery
bottle,
products at a much lower price than what we would pay, which would be cost plus a 20%, 18% margin. And so that spread, you know, is like, you know, a solid 15%, 12 to 15%. And so, you know, Infra is trying to pool resources in order to be able to get better pricing for its membership, but it's a challenge. You know, the distributor also needs us because that's where they make their money, because they're not making their money on the Whole Foods of the world. I mean, they just act as a
way to move product.
Exactly. I mean, and it helps keep the trucks full, which is really critical in how food gets around. I mean, if your trucks are half full, then you're wasting a lot of money.
So I want to thank you very much for being here tonight and really for all of your insight and information. And I encourage all of you to visit their markets and support grocers who are doing the right thing. Again, thank you, Sam McGannum of Buy Right Market, Rex Stewart of New Leaf Market, and Michael May of Harvest Hill Markets. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Good questions.